First of all, I'd like to thank Louis for inviting me to come here today. It's a pleasure to be in PI. It's a very interactive place. Secondly, I'd like to mention that this work was developed in collaboration with Oscar Diaz, a postdoc currently at Saclay in Paris, and with Gary Horowitz. If you want to know more about this work, this is the archive number upon which this work is based. So let me first disentangle this title. So I'm here in the beginning of this afternoon to tell you that the anti-de Sitter space is unstable. That's the claim. Okay? But it's not unstable to any type of instability. It's unstable with respect to a mechanism that is reminiscent of what happens in turbulence. Okay? And it happens in the gravity sector. Thus the name, gravitational turbulent instability of anti-de Sitter. Okay? So why did we bother to study the stability of anti-de Sitter? Of course, the main motivation comes from the CFT correspondence, which relates certain properties of D-1 quantum field theories, typically conformal field theories, with those of a D-dimensional theory of gravity. Okay, it's a strong, weak duality. It's very difficult to prove, but it's a very useful duality. So according to this correspondence, any gravitational phenomena that occurs in ADS should have a CFT description, okay, and vice versa. So it seems a natural arena to study open questions in field theory, if we can solve it on the gravity side. For instance, transport properties in strongly coupled field theories, quantum turbulence, which is something that I'm hopefully going to tackle, and so on and so forth. Now, if you're really enthusiastic about ADS CFT, we can turn it upside down. And maybe there's almost no evidence for this because it's really difficult to do the calculations in this regime. Maybe you can even see the weak coupling CFT as a definition for non-perturbative string theory. Of course, there's almost no evidence here because nobody knows how to do this. So the type of problems that I want to describe today, they're mainly related with far from equilibrium dynamics. Now, that's really difficult on both sides. Even at weak coupling, it's a pain to do quantum field theory with time-dependent couplings, for instance. From the gravity side, as Louis Lehner can tell you, it's a pain to solve Einstein equations with time dependence. So here we'll take a poor man's approach to study this type of phenomena, and we'll see when perturbation theory breaks down. So we'll study instabilities about the background, and this should be seen as the onset of some interesting dynamics. That's what we're going to do. So this is the plan of my talk. Don't get scared. First, we're going to describe some properties about anti-de Sitter space that we'll need during my talk. Then we're going to describe the similarities and differences in what stability is concerned for Minkowski, de Sitter, and anti-de Sitter. Usually, when I give this talk, this is the point where I'll make the claim of my talk. And when I give this talk, people usually ask me a bunch of questions. They immediately say, oh, this is impossible. Anti-de Sitter is supersymmetric, or there is a positivity of energy theorem, and so on, so it should be unstable. I'll try to explain that all of there is basically folklore. Okay, it tells you nothing about stability. That's section number 3. Heuristic takes an age, sorry. Then I'll give you some heuristic arguments for why anti-de Sitter is in fact unstable and that we should have expected to be unstable from scratch. Then I'm going to try to explain you how we go about to prove that anti-de Sitter is unstable. And I'll give you, as a warm-up exercise, the result corresponding to linear gravitational perturbations about global anti-de Sitter. Then I'll again come back to the general structure of what you're going to do next, give two examples. One which I call geons for reasons which will be apparent later, and one example where we collide two of such objects, okay? This is the section where I will show that anti-de Sitter is unstable. Then I'll give some string theory embedding of this picture and the field theory interpretation that we cooked up, okay? If I have time, I will talk about this seemingly different topic, which is the construction of gravitational hairy black holes with a single U1. But as you'll see, this is very close connected with the construction of these other objects, which I call geons. In the end, I'll give some conclusions and some open questions. So what is anti-de Sitter? Anti-de Sitter is a maximally symmetric solution to Einstein's gravity coupled to a negative cosmological constant. In global coordinates, it takes this very, very simple form that is here. So it's time translation invariant. There is a time-like killing vector d/dt. There is a radial coordinate, which basically it's like the analog of the radial coordinate of Minkowski written in spherical coordinates. And if you freeze t and r, you get a round d-2 sphere with radius r, okay? Now, there is another set of coordinates that is extensively used in the literature, which are the Poincaré coordinates. However, the Poincaré coordinates do not cover the entire of spacetime. You only cover a wedge, okay? There is a very neat visualization of this. We just work with the conformal metric. So basically we multiply this metric by L over R. And if you do that, then you can see that this is basically maps to a metric that corresponds to the interior of a cylinder, okay? In this representation, if you do that, anti-de-Sitter looks like this. It's like a cylinder or the interior of a cylinder, okay? It so happens that the Poincaré patch only covers this wedge here inside the cylinder, okay? Now, the effect that I'm going to describe only occurs if you look at global ADS. If you're inside the static patch, it will be very, very, very difficult to see it. So you have to go to global ADS. That's where it naturally lives. The dual field theory, if you're doing global ADS, does not live in flat space. Instead, it lives on R cross S d minus 2. Okay, so it lives on a sphere, which is basically the boundary of this cylinder. Okay? Now, throughout the talk, we are going to consider some boundary conditions that preserve the asymptotic charges. So it means that we're not going to deform our metric at infinity and so on and so forth. If you impose this type of boundary conditions, then one can show that waves in ADS disperse, go towards the boundary, bounce off the boundary, and return to you in a finite amount of time. So basically, ADS acts like a confining box. And that's the picture that I want you to have from ADS. It's a box. Incidentally, that's why ADS was investigated in the first place. They wanted to find a box, a gravitational box, without introducing explicit walls. Okay, so what is known about the stability of the De-Sitter, Minkowski, and anti-De-Sitter space? At the linear level, that is to say, if you perturb your space-time by an infinitesimal perturbation, they all look the same. They all look stable. Okay? This is a very easy calculation, which I shall repeat here. However, for the nonlinear case, what I mean here by nonlinear case is if you take out finite size effects, you put a little bit of a perturbation, but its square is not zero, okay? Then it was shown by Christodoulou and Kleinerman in a tour de force calculation in 93, it's 500 pages proof, that Minkowski and the De-Sitter spacetimes are stable, nonlinearly stable. This means that if you add a small but finite perturbation to your space, it will remain small. It will never form, say, black holes. Now, the first time I heard of this result, I just thought, ah, these relativists, they don't care about the anti-De-Sitter. That's why they didn't even include it in their proof. Maybe it's just something technical. That's what I thought. But then many years have passed without people returning to this problem and, you know, asking if anti-De-Sitter space was stable or not. So why is it the case? Why has this result not been shown? And the reason is very simple. It's just not true. Okay? It is not true that if you add a small but finite perturbation inside ADS, that this perturbation will not grow. Okay? So this is the main claim of my talk. Generically small but finite. It has to be finite. Perturbations of ADS become large. This part of the claim we can actually prove and eventually form black holes. This part, we have very good evidence, but we cannot show. Okay, what we can show is that they grow. And you have to include finite size effects. Furthermore, this instability is not any type of instability. This is an instability that transfers the energy to higher and higher frequency modes. Precisely in the same way that the onset of turbulence does. Either if the turbulence is quantum or classical. That is to say, imagine that you're studying a flow between two parallel plates, okay? So it's a so-called Pazuwil flow. Now you have a certain fluid here, you start cranking up the velocity of the fluid, eventually you'll enter a turbulent state. The onset of this instability is described by a process that transmits its energy to higher and higher frequency modes, okay? It's precisely the same. And you can do this with the quantum fluid, or you can do this with the Navier-Stokes equation. OK. So usually when I give this talk, this is the first question. Ah, you're completely wrong. Because anti-De-Sitter is supersymmetric, so we all know that supersymmetry guarantees stability. And some people just say, well, there is a positivity of energy. So how do you evade this? If there is a positivity of energy, it must be that anti-De-Sitter is stable. Now, usually, people use the first one to prove the second. The first one just tells you that your Hamiltonian is like the square of certain quantity, and so you have a positivity of energy theorem. Let me tell you what the positivity of energy theorem. Basically, the answer to these two questions is no. It does not show that anti-de-Sitter is stable. Let me just remind you of what is the positivity of energy theorem. It tells you that if you can even add matter to your system, and if this matter obeys some reasonable conditions, then it is true that for all non-singular asymptotically ADS initial data, the energy is bounded below, okay? Being exactly zero for anti-de-Sitter only.
Embed anti-de-Sitter in a supersymmetric theory, in string theory, there are supersymmetric anti-de-Sitter vacuum.
Yes.
There are non-supersymmetric anti-de-Sitter vacuum as well.
Sure.
But if you take a supersymmetric vacuum, it's stable. That's a theory.
It's not.
You're forgetting about the fermion zero modes. When you compute the decay rate, you have to.
No. As you said, no, this is. I think what you're telling me is that it's linearly stable, and I agree with that statement.
No, it's stable.
I can't clarify this. What you mean to say is that it's energetically stable, and what he's saying is that it's
dynamically unstable.
No, I'm saying you compute the decay amplitude and it's zero.
Tell me something. Can you show that if you add a small but finite perturbation in your space-time, you will not form a black hole?
You should compute the decay amplitude.
But that does not tell you that if you add a small but finite perturbation to your space-time, you will not deform the asymptotic of your space-time. It will tell you that it will remain small. But it will not tell you that, it will tell you that, if it's infinitesimal, it will stay there. But if you include finite size effects, it doesn't tell you that. Okay? And I'm going to tell you why it doesn't tell you that. What this tells you, both of them, is that anti-de-Sitter space cannot decay. That's what this tells you. It tells you that anti-de-Sitter cannot evolve to a space of lower energy. It doesn't tell you that if you add a small perturbation, that you will not generically create a black hole. Usually, the way that you go about of this is to argue that waves disperse. That's how you go about. That's why it works in flat space, because you perturb it a little bit and waves disperse off to infinity and never come back. You see, and the problem is that this does not happen in ADS, because in anti-de-Sitter space, whatever is the amount of perturbation that you put inside, the perturbation will go off to infinity, bounce off the walls, and return to you. There's no way around. It will always return to you. In fact, I can tell you that the type of theorem that we're going to prove to you here happens if you have almost any PDE inside a finite domain. It's a standard law in PDEs. In a way, the only thing that we're doing here is to prove that Einstein's equations are not special. Nonlinear PDE. Of course, if you put photons inside the box, this will not happen.
How do you understand the first and second statement? Cannot decay, evolution toward a black hole is a decay or it's not a decay?
It's not a decay, because what you're having is you add a little bit of energy and you can form a black hole with that energy, with that amount of energy. So in that sense, it doesn't decay to something with a lower energy. That's where the difference is. But what you can prove is that it's unstable. We cannot prove it forms black holes. I'll give you very good evidence, hopefully, that it will form a black hole. Let me give you an example. It's clear with an example. Let us consider Minkowski space, okay, coupled to a scalar field. In this case, there is a positivity of energy, and it is true that finite but small perturbations remain small. This was shown by Christodoulou and Kleinerman in 1993. Okay? Let us now switch the kinetic term of the scalars. We know that it's a very pathological theory. In particular, it does not have a positivity of energy. But it's still true that Minkowski space is nonlinearly stable. It's still true, even though there is no positivity of energy. It's still true that if you start with a small perturbation, it will disperse off to infinity. The example that I'm going to give you today goes the other way around. Okay, so why is anti-de-Sitter unstable? What is the heuristic argument? And again, heuristics should take an edge. Yeah, but what I'm saying is that Minkowski, I'm not saying that the theory is not sick in all possible ways. But what I'm saying is that Minkowski space, if you start with small enough, and that's where the problems of proving these theorems are, it's to define a norm. But if you start with small enough amplitude scalar field, it will not form a black hole in the future. It doesn't tell you that if you know that there's all sorts of pathologies with this theory, which we know there are.
Excuse me. My understanding is that you bounce off of infinity, sort of come back and focus and do something. Is it one bounce or many bounces?
Perfect. Yeah, I will answer to that question. Sometimes you need an excruciating amount of bouncing. It might be, it might take an ergodic time. And this is related with this, okay? So ADS acts like a confining box, which means that if you put a little bit of energy or a certain excitation about ADS, and if you wait long enough, you might expect this perturbation to explore all configuration spaces that are available. One such space are small black holes. So this tells you that you might have to wait an awful long time for this to happen, okay? But eventually, it will happen. However, this argument also tells you that probably there are some very contrived solutions that you can construct that will not do this. They have to be very, very, very special. They cannot be generic. But if you manipulate them so hard, probably you can get some that evade this, okay? In fact, they exist. I'm going to show you what they are. And they basically, you can bring, if you start with a normal mode of ADS, with a specific value for L and M in terms of the spherical harmonics, you can back react it to all orders in perturbation theory, and the solution is regular at all times. Okay? We coined this solution Gion, basically because Gions were not proposed by us. They were proposed by Wheeler in 72. And he wanted to use Gions as a model for elementary particles. Of course, this didn't work because Gions do not exist in flat space. They're unstable. But basically, Gions are just objects that are held together by their own gravitational field strength. Okay? In Minkowski space, this does not exist because the waves disperse to infinity. Here, they're confined. That's why they will exist. But they have to be very, very special solutions. And indeed, they are. These solutions are exactly periodic in time, and they're invariant under a single continuous symmetry. Okay? They have a very special U1. It's a helical U1. Okay? And they're very special in the sense that they are exactly periodic in time. And gions are basically the analog of plane waves, gravitational plane waves in the, so this is more for gravity people. They're the analog of gravitational plane waves in the Minkowski space. Now, if you have this picture in mind, then it doesn't come as a surprise that eventually you'll form black holes, because Penrose proved, actually a beautiful paper published in Nature in 71, that if you collide two plane waves, you always form a black hole. So if you regard this as being true, then it follows that anti-de-Sitter must be unstable by shocking two of these guys. Okay. So how do we go about to prove this? Usually, if you want to study perturbation theory, you do linear perturbation theory. Basically, you set your metric as being your reference metric, say ADS background, plus some perturbation. And typically, you neglect the back reaction at higher orders. Here, we're not going to neglect them. We're going to include them. So there's an infinite series here. Okay? At each order in perturbation theory, Einstein equations always have the same form. Okay? It always looks like a certain second-order operator, which is like a close cousin of the Lichtenrovich operator. Just see it as a wave operator acting on a tensor, equal to some source term. Now, this looks very simple because I'm hiding all of the mass here. The important thing is that this operator only depends on the background, okay? Whereas this side of the equation depends on the metric perturbations at all orders below. For instance, the second order tensor here, it has a specific name. It's called the Landau-Lifshitz pseudo-tensor. And it depends on the first order perturbation and its second derivatives, and up to second derivatives, okay? If you go higher and higher in perturbation theory, this object gets, it occupies hundreds of pages to write them to write it down. And in order to see the effect that I'm about to describe, you have to go to fourth order. Now, it was shown, and it's not very difficult to understand this, that any smooth symmetric tensor on the sphere that sits inside ADS can be decomposed as a sum of very simple building blocks that have some very special transformations under the sphere, the diffeomorphisms, okay? Basically, all I'm saying here is there is a Clebsch-Gordan decomposition for tensors. That's just this, okay? So you start with a tensor that is regular on the sphere, and you can write it as a sum of other tensors which are very simple, okay? Might be an infinite sum, but there is a sum. And you sum over L and M, which are deformations, azimuthal deformations on a sphere, or, sorry, yeah, azimuthal, no, this is the other direct. Well, they correspond to direct to deformations on the sphere, either azimuthal or the other ones. So let us focus D equals 4. We have done the calculation for D equals 5. The same phenomena happens. But for the purpose of this presentation, it's better to choose D equals 4. Yes, we'll have to impose gauge conditions at each order. You're asking me, I'll tell you later what type of it, but yes, yes. But it turns out that we'll always be working with gauge invariant quantities anyway. But we'll, that's a good one, thank you. Now, in D equals 4, life is simpler because in general, you see these ages, these building blocks can be of three types. They can either be scalar type perturbations, which are basically perturbations that transform under scalars for diffeomorphisms on the sphere. They can be vector type perturbations, which in this context, because we are in four dimensions, they're just the Hodge dual of gradients of the usual spherical harmonics. That's it. So these guys are perturbations that are built out of the spherical harmonics. These guys are perturbations that are built out of the dual of the gradients of spherical harmonics. And because we are in four dimensions, there's no tensor modes. There's no tensor modes on the two sphere. Okay? So you only need to worry about these top two building blocks. Let me just give you a technicality. It's the only technicality that I'm going to give here. But because we want to go beyond linear order, we have to find a real representation for the spherical harmonics, which means that instead of considering one spherical harmonic for one given L and M, we have to consider two, because there's cosines and there's sines. This is a technicality, and it only shows up because we want to go higher order in perturbation theory. Now, it's possible to show, and a lot of the work goes in this next step. I'm not going to explain you how. But it's possible to show that at each order in perturbation theory, all you have to do is to solve four PDEs. If you solve four PDEs, you know the solution up to that order, up to a given order. Why four? Well, there's one for scalar types, there's one for vector types, and there's one for sines and one for cosines. That's why you have four, okay? And at each order in perturbation theory, they decouple. And they always look the same. It's always the same operator that you would have, even if you were considering just the linear perturbations, equal to some source term, which is very complicated. That's where all the mess is hidden again. The important thing is that this side is the result. So if this was zero, this is the result that you would obtain if you are in first order. And now there's just some source term, okay, which is built from the orders below. So this delta 2 is just the wave operator. We got rid of all of the angular dependence, so it's the wave operator in the TR space. So basically, you look at the metric in global EDS, and you throw away the sphere. You get the two-dimensional orbit space. This potential is always the same as if you were perturbing EDS. Oh, you know, you're absolutely right. It's cosine of M phi. Thank you. Now, typically, we're a little bit in a better shape because the choice of initial data typically relates the sines with the cosines. And so at each order in perturbation theory, you actually only have to solve two PDEs. But this has to do with some choice of initial data. But at each order in perturbation theory, we have to solve for two PDEs for each value of L and M. Okay? Boundary conditions. We're solving PDEs. We better have some boundary conditions. At the origin, these, so let me go back to tell you also that these quantities here are gauge invariant at each order in perturbation theory. Okay? So that's important. So these quantities, which have a name in the literature, they're called the Kodama-Ishibashi variables. Regularity just requires that at the origin, they should go as r to the power of l. They have to decay sufficiently smooth at the origin. And now at infinity, it came as a surprise, their behavior. There's two terms. There's either a function of time, or it goes as 1 over r. Now, we want to impose boundary conditions that do not deform the sphere at infinity. If you look at this and you want to say, you know, I don't want to deform the leading term, you would be tempted to kill this term, right? And in fact, that's what everybody did in the literature. So everybody that has calculated, say, quasi-normal modes of Rice and Ostrom, of Schwarzschild ADS black holes, did this, kill this term. It turns out that that's the wrong quantization. this is the gauge invariant quantity, but you still have to, in order to give the proper boundary condition, you have to go to the metric. Hey, David. You have to go to the metric perturbations. And once you go to the metric perturbations, you realize that if you don't want to deform the sphere at infinity, you actually have to kill the subleading term. This is a problem that only occurs in four dimensions. In five dimensions, it's this one and above. Okay? You have actually contact people that do quasi-normal modes, such as Vitor Cardoso, and they agree that they were wrong. They chose the wrong thing. So quasi-normal modes of anti-de-Sitter black holes in four dimensions are wrong. This corresponds to a conformal deformation of the sphere.
So a constant conformal transfer?
It's not a constant. It depends on a bunch of the angles in the time.
Okay, but a conformal transformation is not going to zero.
Yes, on the sphere, not on time. Or else you could reabsorb it the way that you want, right?
Okay.
So this one is the one that sets it. There's nothing at infinity for this choice. Let me also tell you that this is a choice that conforms with the usual definition of finite gravitational energy. Either if you use the Ashta-Cardass formalism, which is a fancy formalism, or if you just put this in the Landau stress tensor and you calculate the energy. So this is really the right energy, okay? Okay, so what are our findings at linear level? This is known before us. Many people knew about this result. Kodama and Ishibashi were the first ones, I think. So there's no source term in this case if you are at linear order, so I should be one here. So we can take advantage of the fact that our solution is translation invariant. So we can still decompose, time translation invariant, so you can still decompose it as a sum of cosines and sines. So that's what we do here. Then we put this into the equation that I've shown you before, and we find that the frequencies, or its square, it's always positive. Okay? And it's quantized. Here is L, and this is 2p, which is basically counts the number of radial modes. Because there's also another extra quantum number. These are the so-called normal modes of anti-de-Sitter. They were known for a very long time. And the fact that this quantity is positive just means that the anti-de-Sitter is linearly stable. That's the statement that was known a very long time ago. You get the two. that's exactly true. You get the two here. This should be a one. Now, just for the sake of presentation, let us set p equals to 0, no radial overtones. And then the solution to that complicated equation is just basically a rational function of R and L, where L is the cosmological length. So I've just presented here. And A is some normalization constant. The point is, you know exactly what these guys are. OK? So what is the general structure? The general structure is we solve for the gauge invariant quantity at first order, for instance. And then we have to go from the gauge invariant quantity to the metric perturbations. It so happens that we show in our paper that there is a linear map that takes you from the gauge invariant quantity to the metric perturbations. Of course, this map is given in a given gauge. For instance, the traceless transverse gauge is a gauge that you can choose, or the Donder gauge to be more specific. So at each order in perturbation theory, there is a map that takes you to the metric perturbations. Why do we need to go to the metric perturbations? We need to go really to the metric perturbations because we need to construct the right-hand side of the Einstein equations that depend on the metric perturbations at a lower order. This is where, say, 30% of the work goes, computing this guy analytically. Where 70% of work goes is then to decompose these guys as a sum of the building blocks that I told you before. There's no systematic way of doing Clebsch-Gordan decomposition for tensors. So you have to do it by inspection. It's a pain. Okay? For instance, at second order, you can find as many as 70 of these guys of LNMs, for each of which you have to solve two PDEs. So you might end up with something like 140 PDEs at each order to solve, which we've solved analytically. So after you have this guy, then you just compute the source term. It's a map, a linear map. And then you determine the gauge invariant function. Okay? So why will there be an instability, or where can we see that an instability will occur if you do this? Well, you see, if the source term has an harmonic dependence in time, then one can easily show, by doing some method of annihilators, for instance, that the corresponding solution will exhibit the exact same type of harmonic dependence in time. You can show this. There is one exception. And the exception is when the frequency of the source term is exactly equal to the frequency of a normal mode in ADS. If that happens, there is an oscillatory term, but there's also a term that grows linearly in time. This is the exact same thing that happens if you consider an harmonic oscillator and you add a source term. If the source term has exactly the same frequency as the harmonic oscillator frequency, then there is a term that grows linearly in time. Okay? This, if these modes are present, then they're said to be resonant. Okay? Now, this gives us an operational way of defining what we mean by stable or unstable. If, for a given perturbation, we can construct these guys to all orders in perturbation theory, and if terms that grow linearly in time never show up, then this corresponds to some stable background. Okay?
Takes as a definition that when you get an imaginary frequency, that means it's stable.
But that's because you're focusing on linear perturbations. On linear perturbations, you're absolutely right. It grows up exponentially in time. Linear. This is a nonlinear perturbation. It grows power law in time. That's why you cannot find them if you want by doing the linear analysis. You're right. Linearly stable, the imaginary part of the frequency has to be negative, such that you get some quasi-normal modes or something like that. Here, they're growing not exponential. They're growing in a power law way.
So how is a definition of what one means by instability?
An instability means I can tell exactly what
grows how much? Power type?
No.
Logarithmically?
That's right. You're alluding at a very important point. It's how to define that the space-time is unstable or unstable. In this context, we found an easy way of doing it. What you have to show, in fact, is that if you start with some initial data at a given Cauchy surface, the future of that initial data will be similar to the one without the initial data that you put in. That's what it means to be stable. No, you're not alluding to any time dependence. You're not alluding to any coordinate dependence. It means that the future of that initial surface has to have the same structure. That's what it means by stability. And that's the only way of defining stability, without either referring to growth or anything like that. The future development of a given Cauchy surface.
So just intuitively, I mean, generically, it's not going to happen for a while, but as it sloshes back and forth, eventually it finds one of those resonant ones,
yes,
and then just starts,
yes,
growing.
Yes.
And that could take a huge amount of time.
It can, perfect.
But you're saying eventually it's going to find it.
No, I'm saying a little bit more than that. I'm saying that we found modes that do that. And
yeah,
to prove that something is unstable.
I mean, for a generic perturbation is eventually going to find this.
Yes.
And a fine-tuned one will.
Might evade it.
Might evade it eternally.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the point. Thank you.
But, you know, I'm actually puzzled because this generically happens anytime you do nonlinear perturbation theory.
No, it does not. I'm going to show you. Ah.
So, like, if you take a harmonic oscillator, right, have x squared and x to the fourth, and just do.
But you can resum.
Exactly. So you can resum things. But
perfect.
This is when you be able to resum things here. Yeah.
And I'll show you examples where you can and examples where you cannot.
Perfect.
So we took care of that. It's a change of basis. And don't worry, we took care of that. You'll see examples where we have to resum. Basically, resumming in this context means that the frequency that you started with, you'll have to change at second order. Let us give an example where you'll see this happening. Let us imagine that you start with some initial data that just has one value of L and one value of M. Okay? So a normal mode of ADS. That's how we start. A single normal mode of ADS. We go to second order, and there are no resonant modes. In fact, we can show analytically that that's every even order, there are no resonant modes. Only at odd order, they can occur. Okay? And the solution is regular everywhere. Second order, all fine and good. After solving some 100 ODEs, you discover that it's all fine and good. You get a bit depressed. Then let's go to third order. At third order, we find one mode that potentially grows up in time. However, you can resum your this term by changing the frequency slightly by your perturbation parameter. Okay? So you can do something fancy and you can reabsorb that term that grows linearly in time. That's what this means. Okay? So the term, by the end of the day, is not there, exactly as you were pointing out. Now, the structure of the equations we went to fifth order indicates that there is only one resonant term at each order, and you can always remove it by changing this frequency slightly, okay? We have not done this at to infinity, so we're giving evidence for the existence of these solutions. But up to at least the first two non-trivial orders, it exists, can be made regular. Now, for the sake of you know, checking if our computations are correct, because again, this involves solving many, many ODEs, we have computed the asymptotic charges of these solutions, and they obey to the first law of thermodynamics. So this is a good check of our calculations. And in fact, this also provides a meaning, a physical meaning, for what we define by being our parameter, epsilon. It's nothing but related with the angular velocity of this solution. So this provides a physical meaning for our parameter.
Corresponding black hole set.
There's no black hole here, just ADS.
No, I'm just asking if you can delay this till later, but is it easy to tell me whether that has more mass or less mass than the corresponding black hole with that same angular momentum?
It will have the same, the black hole that it created as conservation of energy, so it will have the same energy and the same angular momentum.
Keep going.
Even though I will not be able to show that this form of black hole, I will. You will see. Note that the symmetry of the solution that we started with, which I'm going to show in a little bit, it's not the same as the one that we get at a given order. The reason being that you see, the solution that we start with is a helical killing field, okay, which is the one that I present here. Basically, you can recast your solution as depending only on these combinations, omega t minus m phi. But we are redefining the frequency, okay? So at each order in perturbation theory, you don't have the same symmetry that you started with, which tells you that you cannot just exponentiate your linear result to get this solution. So there's no easy way of getting this solution nonlinearly. You really have to work hard at each order. So this is exactly what I said, because this guy has changed. Now, let me go back to what you just said, because this is interesting. The resonances in ADS occur very easily because they're integers. The frequencies are quantized in integers. However, these gions, they will have normal modes that are continuous deformations of the normal modes of ADS. So maybe you can find some pockets of ergodicity, which basically it's what you're saying. It will take a very, very, very long time to form black holes, just basically because the frequencies here are not integers, so it's much more difficult to find combinations of omegas that give the same frequency as the resonant frequencies. So gions are likely to be a little bit more stable, and by this I mean it might take a much longer time to eventually find a resonant frequency. Now let us start with the interesting case. We have two gions, so we have L equals 2, M equals 2, and L equals 4, and M equals 4. Okay, we go to second order. It's the exact same thing. Here, you have to, I can't even remember the number of equations that you solve for this case. At second order and at all even orders, it's all fine, it's all good, okay? At third order, there are four resonant modes. There are four modes that could potentially grow in time, okay? Two of these modes, they're just there because we're not using the right basis, okay? We can resum them. And we can resum them by basically changing the frequencies of our initial solution slightly. Okay? There is another mode, which is the mode that is resonant and that has the smallest frequency of the resonant modes, that is just not there. You never need to add that term in order for the solution to be regular in R. And this is the term that is resonant but has the smallest frequency amongst the resonant terms. This will be important. There is a term that still shows up there that cannot be set to zero no matter how you do. You try to resum your series, and you can never set this guy to zero. And it so happens that the frequency of this mode, it's exactly the highest possible frequency that a resonant mode could have at that order and for these two initial frequencies. And this is a mode that is growing in time, okay? And it has the highest possible, I stress, the highest possible resonant frequency at this order. So this means that first, ADS is nonlinearly unstable because there's one mode that is growing linearly in time, and we can never get rid of it. If you go to fourth order, it will go quadratically in time, and so on and so forth. Sorry, fifth order. So we cannot get rid of this. And furthermore, the frequency of the mode that is dominant is starting to increase. Okay. So the frequency of the growing mode is higher than any of the frequencies we started with. Okay. Now the energy is transferred, or the, if you want, the amplitude of your initial perturbation is starting to be transferred to modes of higher and higher energy, just like you observe in a cascading phenomenon in turbulence. Okay? So this is this statement. And we expect this to continue, because eventually this mode becomes, and for some particular statements we have checked this, eventually this mode becomes much more important than the other ones. It will resonate with the ones that you started with, and it will create higher and higher frequencies. So you expect this cascading behavior to go for a very, very, very long time. Now, you're having more and more energy into modes of higher and higher frequency. The natural resolution for this in GR, well, eventually it will form a rotating black hole. Okay? Now, this is just la, 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 blah, blah, blah. I have no proof of this. However, let us consider a very simple setup. This setup was worked out before our work by Bizon and Rotorowski. Rotorowski, I can't pronounce that. So they consider a very simple setup. They consider a spherical symmetric system, okay, coupled to a scalar field. And they studied gravitational collapse of this system. Okay? They find, and there they're not doing perturbation theory. They're doing the full-time evolution of GR. Okay? And what they find is that no matter how small is the amplitude of the perturbation that you start with, you will always form a black hole. This work is, they did a lot more than what we did. They followed the full-time evolution. They really show that DDS is unstable. There's no resonance, blah, blah, blah here. They really show that anti-de Sitter is unstable. Here is a plot of what they find. So this is the amplitude of the pulse that you start with. And this is the radius of the horizon in some units. Every time you see a hump, basically it means one reflection, two reflections of the ADS wall, three, four, five, six, seven. So if you start with a very small amplitude, sometimes you have to wait, you know, a lot of reflections until you form a black hole. But eventually, you always form. Okay? So in this case, it's really unstable. There's no way out. Oh, every time you see a curve, it's a black hole that was formed. So here, a black hole was formed for epsilon of 30, and the size of the black hole is given by this thing. Okay? So here, they have shown what we have done is something more complicated, just gravity, no scalar field. And we have shown the same thing at the nonlinear level, but we don't know if it will stop in one of these black, you know, we don't know which black hole it will settle in the end. We take these results, and we conjecture based on that. Okay, so we cannot show that the black hole forms in our case. So what happens in string theory? Now in string theory, life is a little bit more complicated.
So they showed that there is a singularity that is formed and that's covered by a horizon?
Yes.
And they got evidence for both? Or what?
Except there is one exception. That's a good question. I didn't want to go in that, but thank you for asking. You see these points here? At these points, they find naked singularities. A singularity is formed, but it's naked. But it's very fine-tuned, right? It has to be exactly there, a little bit of. And at each of these points, they find the same critical behavior that Shoptik found, because basically the black holes are so small, they work back in flat space. Okay, but they generically see the formation of a singularity, and it's covered by an horizon. And the black hole that they find in the end, it's always Schwarzschild ADS. In our case, if I have time, I hope I have time, I will tell you that it's a little bit more complicated. It might not be the Curry DS solution. So let us see what happens in string theory. This is the part where you can all say, oh, you're absolutely wrong.
Can I, before you get onto this thing? So people studied analogous problems in the asymptotic flat case. They use the strange word of linear instability.
Oh, linear instability.
Well,
it's
linearization.
It's a different thing. It's a different,
so
yeah.
No,
no, it's a different phenomena there. There it's to see if.
Yeah.
So what they want to.
I mean, they actually put positive results that you didn't have linearization.
But the linearization instability is not this instability. Okay, so I'm going to tell you what. Yes, so linearization instability, this is a good point. It means that if you found a linear solution, that is infinitesimally small, and you believe that it exists at a nonlinear level.
Yeah.
That's one thing. Here, it's a different statement. Your statement is a statement about the existence, about how you can extrapolate the linear result.
Yeah.
And this, well, in a way, they're a little bit connected. What I'm saying here is that these modes exist, the ones that are linear, but eventually they will slosh around in from a black hole, which is something different.
Well, it might be related. Because
no, it is. I understand what you're saying. It is a little bit related, but this is more the long time. Yours is more about the existence of these modes once they're back reactive.
Well, the question is, did they prove it for a long time?
No, they can only prove for. Yes, yes, it is, and you do a lot of assumptions in which ADS doesn't fall.
Yeah, so I was just wondering what assumptions.
I can't remember. There's somebody here in Waterloo that I'm supposed to talk with maybe next tomorrow that knows about that. So let us go to string theories. So in this case, it's a little bit more complicated because we are working actually in ADS. 5 process 5. There's only one length because the size of that guy has to be basically the size of that guy. And now there are two energy scales, the Planck scale and the string scale. And you're going to consider the scenario, which is the most useful one, in which the string scale is smaller than the Planck scale. Now we are in ADS CFT, so we can recast the Planck scale in a funny way. It's related basically with N and L. And if you start with an initial energy that is larger than this quantity, classically, this always happens, then one forms a five-dimensional black hole. That's what we have shown. This is classically. However, if you give an energy that is in between the energy of a black hole with a string size, called the correspondence energy, and the Planck energy, then in fact one forms a 10-dimensional black hole. Basically, you have enough energy to see the extra dimension, or you actually probe the extra dimension. That's what this means. If you give an energy that is in between the string energy and the correlation energy, you just excite the string. After all of this cascading effect, eventually you excite the string. There's no black hole here. And finally, if you are deep down in a quantum regime, then the cascade stops at the energy that you started with, just because you can think intuitively, the black holes that it would form would be so small that it would Hawking evaporate so fast that they're not really black holes. In a nutshell, quantum mechanically, there's no instability. That's what this means. Okay? Because the black holes, you know, if you form black holes that are smaller than the Planck length, well, is that a black hole, really? I mean, it evaporates too fast. Okay, now comes the most interesting part. The fact that one is evolving towards a state of maximum entropy, if we actually reach the black hole, tells you that you are thermalizing. But thermalizing, not in the canonical ensemble, but in the microcanonical ensemble. Okay, that's where we're working, because we're doing time evolution and making the conserved charge constant. This is an argument that is not due to us. It's due to Joe Polchinski. So I should give him credit for this argument. So all theories with a gravity dual, because they all include gravity, will show this cascade of energy just like the onset of terminals, because we prove it just for gravity. Okay. This raises a puzzle. I believe that you have discussed this puzzle already here. The puzzle is the following. Turbulence, as dictated by the Navier-Stokes equations, depends on the number of dimensions. Or the qualitative features of turbulence depends on the number of dimensions. If you are in 2+1 dimensions, you can show that there is an additional conserved charge, which I will not even attempt to pronounce. It's this one. And one can show that the flow of energy actually occurs in the other way around of the one that we have shown here. It goes from small scales to very large scales. That's the reason why we have weather, because a small perturbation can cause a large disturbance. Here we're saying at least that strongly coupled quantum theories goes in the other way around. Okay? Of course, there is a very big caveat to this statement, and it's the fact that our black holes are really, really small. We are deep down in some quantum regime, so how much we can use, you know, how much intuition can we get from the Navier-Stokes equation? You know, it's not clear.
Are you talking about the equation at the boundary or in the bulk?
That's also a very good question, right? So it's clear that in the bulk, there's no way, because the black holes are just too tiny. On the boundary theory, well, it's strong coupling. If it was weak coupled, you could actually cook up something called the Gross-Petayevsky equation, which is supposed to describe some quantum turbulent flow. But I don't believe that thing exists as strong coupling, that equation. So you're right, it's even a little bit, it's a little bit more elusive. But let me give you this piece of evidence, which I think it's nice. So Gary gave this exact same talk in a much better way than me, as expected, in Santa Barbara. And so this was in a condensed matter physics community was listening to this talk. And when he said that we were observing the cascade in a different direction, they got very excited. Because they are perturbing quantum critical points, which is supposed to be described by this, and they do see the cascade that we're saying, in the direction that we're saying, not as dictated by the Navier-Stokes equation. Of course, we are in a completely different setup. The setup in which they're working, you know, it's the experimental setup is very different from what we have here. But it's still suggested that the cascade goes in the opposite direction. Okay, and that's all I know about that work. So, a perhaps much more intriguing fact is that we have some excited states on the CFT that do not thermalize. They do not decay away, even though they're on a sphere. That's a bit puzzling. So these gions, they're spin two excitations at the linear level. So once you back react them, they basically correspond to both condensates of these guys, and they're basically the analog of glue balls that exist on spheres, okay? That's at least how we interpret them. But these guys do not thermalize. They do, eventually, they don't form black holes. They just exist there. It's a bit puzzling why they should exist on the CFT side. Sorry?
So how can you say that in asymptotically large times, you will not form?
Sorry, I don't understand. Can I show what?
That the gions really do not thermalize never.
Well, all I can tell is that we back reacted them to four further, and we see no problem, and they exist, and the solution shows no sign of forming a black hole. And I can also tell you that in simpler contexts, these objects take a different name. They're not called gions, they're called boson stars. And we have constructed them at the full nonlinear level with non-perturbative effects and so on. But that's all I can give you. These actually, gions, you should think of them as boson stars made out of gravitons. They're a bit funny, but they're basically boson stars. So we have calculated the boundary stress energy tensor of these guys, and as a function of the coordinates on the sphere, so this is the azimuthal angle, this is the other one, which I can't remember, and this is the energy density. And you find pockets of negative and positive energy around the equator. Okay, negative energy density. Furthermore, this solution is invariant under this under this Killing field, which happens to be time-like near the poles, but space-like at the equator. So obviously, nothing is traveling faster than the speed of light. We're not trying to give any neutrino physics here. So what happens at the equator is that our state is very special. We have set our space such that it has negative, positive, negative, positive, and it looks that the space is rotating faster than the speed of light. But it's not. It's just that the state is very special. It's similar to a Christmas tree light effect, if you want. You get your Christmas tree lights, you know, and you set independently a clock at each of these lights. Of course, you can make it as it seems that there's something traveling faster than the speed of light. Of course, this part of the lights are not turning on or off because of the previous one. It's just that you set them independently. So it's if you want, the phase velocity is bigger than the speed of light, but there's no transformation being transferred from one to the other.
Can I choose an AGD6 which say in the negative energy regions?
Sorry?
Can I choose AGD6 at infinity that will not enter the positive energy regions, but stay in the negative energy regions?
You're asking if there is some super dense effect affecting these things.
I'm sorry?
Why do you want to? I don't know.
Oh, well, I'm worried about the average null energy condition.
It's still satisfied because this is just perturbations around the.
Well, no, in the field theory. So you just told us there were regions of negative energy density. So I'm wondering whether you can stay in those in the field theory. In the bulk, you're right. There's no
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. Now, let me change slightly gears and tell you about the construction of some other objects. These are basically gravitational hairy black holes with a single Killing field. They're black holes you only have a single killing field. Okay? And the reason why this is related with what I've shown you before is that basically you can take one of these geons and put a tiny black hole at its center. Okay? Of course, there is one constraint. We have a black hole, so it's better that this black hole has some stationary killing field. And there's only one stationary killing field in the game. It's this one. So it's better that this guy is null on the horizon. But if this guy is null on the horizon, it tells you that the angular velocity of the black hole is given by omega over m. If you know something called super radiance, this should start to ring a bell. Okay. Now, there are infinitely countable, because it depends only on the values of m, many geons labeled by this quantum number m. Okay. This means that this corresponds to a new infinite class of black holes, okay, that only have a single E1. But at this stage, at least those of you that do GR should start looking at me and saying, this guy is completely nuts. Because he's saying that some black holes exist with a single E1. But what about the rigidity theorem proved by Hawking in 72, and then established in a much stronger context by Hollands, Ishibashi, and Wald? I mean, they just tell you that if a black hole is stationary, then it must be axisymmetric. How come you're saying that now you have a black hole that is stationary, but it's not axisymmetric? The point is that in proving this theorem, you must assume, it's an assumption, that the black hole is stationary to a killing field that is not normal to the horizon. Okay? That's an assumption of these theorems. And it so happens that these black holes, by construction, have one killing field that is exactly normal to the horizon. That's why you can evade the rigidity theorem. Okay. This also tells you that the KRDS solution is not the unique stationary black hole in ADS, because there's this infinite tower that lives on them. Okay. So what is the endpoint of the instability? I mean, maybe it's one of these guys. We don't know. It's some rotating black hole, but we don't know exactly which one it is. Now, these black holes, and here Louis might disagree with me, these black holes can be seen as some metastable states that you would find if you try to follow the endpoint of superradiance. Now, I'm not so sure if you're all familiar with superradiance. That's why I have this extra slide here. Basically, superradiance is the wave analog of the Penrose process around a rotating black hole. You take a wave with a definite frequency and the definite angular momentum. You scatter this wave off a rotating black hole, and the reflected amplitude of this wave might be bigger than the one that you sent in. It stole energy from the black hole. Now, if you are in asymptotically flat space, the wave goes in, steals energy, goes out, and that's it. But if you are in ADS, well, we're in a bit of a problem, because the wave goes out, hits the wall, goes back in, steals more energy, goes out, and you can see that this will eventually lead to an instability. So in fact, if you have a black hole that is rotating inside the ADS, there is something called the superradiance instability. Okay. You can also have this instability, and I think you're smiling because of that, in flat space if you consider massive particles, okay, which not something I'm considering here. So for instance, the Kerr solution is unstable because of these modes. The Kerr solution. Kerr with a massive scalar field, yeah.
What is the time scale of this?
Oh, it's so tiny. It's really, really tiny. It's not power law. It's exponential in this case. And it depends on the m that you consider.
The mass of the particle.
Oh, in the case of flat space, it depends on the mass of the particle. That's why people are trying to use this to detect axions at the phenomenological level. Groups in Oxford are trying to do that. Now, let us imagine what is the endpoint. In simple systems, in very simple systems, you can actually follow instability, and you find that basically the endpoint is like one of these rotating black holes that I've just described here, or something very similar to that. According to Louis, there might be some oscillations around, but at least in the systems that we have seen and analyzed, in which you can follow because they're simpler, it seems that the endpoint will be one of these guys. But this corresponds to exciting only the mode that is unstable, nothing else. Okay, so what happens if you consider a superposition of modes? After all, generic perturbation will have a superposition of modes. Well, on one hand, superradiance will cause some of the modes to grow. That's a superradiance instability. On the other hand, far away from the black hole, there's still our turbulence effect, which is sending the frequency to sending the energy to higher and higher frequencies. Okay? So there are two possibilities. At least two possibilities. If the black hole absorbs these higher frequency modes faster than what they can be created, maybe the endpoint is some black hole with some gravitational wave sloshing around, maybe similar to the ones that we've described here. We don't know. Of course, the more interesting situation is if you have actually no endpoint, if there is actually structure that is being created at smaller scales as time passes by. This is still possible, okay? So now I come to the conclusions. So I hope I've convinced you that anti-de Sitter space is non-linearly unstable. So generically, small perturbations become large and probably form black holes. For each linearized gravity mode, there is an exact non-singular region. We managed to construct these guys in simpler setups to all orders in perturbation theory. Here we go to four further. The dual field theory shows this generic turbulent cascade. It's generic because it's just contained inside gravity. So as long as you have gravity, you'll have this. In fact, as long as you're solving a PDE nonlinear inside a compact domain, you'll have this. But there are some special states that manage to evade this. Okay, but they're very special, very fine-tuned. Open questions. Why the hell the energy cascade goes in the other direction? We don't know. Prove a singularity theorem for anti-de Sitter space. So we know that closed universes generically have singularities. This was proved by Penrose. Gary has been trying to work this avenue out, but it looks a lot more complicated. This would show that anti-de Sitter is unstable, okay? Without doing any perturbation theory, we would like to prove this by using some of the machinery of singularity theorems of the 70s. We'd like to understand the late time of behavior of superinducing instability. That's one of the main reasons why I came here. Hopefully, me and Lewis will be able to shed some light on that. And also understand the space of the CFT states that do not thermalize. How large they are. Are they all very different from these ones that we have created? We don't know. Thank you.
So it's interesting that any PDE in a box essentially gives you this inverse.
Non-linear. It does not necessarily need to give the direction of energy that I showed you, but there is a cascade, yes.
Okay, but it's not necessarily always inverted, because it just...
No, because the Navier-Stokes is a good example.
Oh, sorry?
The Navier-Stokes equation tells you that the energy goes in the other way.
Okay, but just because it's the quantum field theory that you're trying to, I mean, they essentially are compact, yeah, right? You're doing global ADS, so the so in some sense, it's just that turbulence or Navier-Stokes equation in a quantum field theory with the compact
Not the Navier-Stokes equations, because the Navier-Stokes equations are supposed to describe a regime of the field theory that is for very long wavelength. And these guys, they will have very short wavelength.
So it's been studied, the Navier-Stokes with compact space?
The Navier-Stokes, I don't want to talk about work that is not mine, especially if somebody is in the room, but the Navier-Stokes equations at the relativistic level have been studied in 2+1 dimensions. And they seem to have the same behavior. Well, in a compact space, you're still working that out, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so in a compact space, we still don't know. Yeah, yes? Any of you too?
There's a viscosity lying around in this kind of
yes.
space. Does the viscosity affect the cascade process?
Not in the AVS sense, because so the endpoint of this turbulent cascade will be a black hole, which is hopefully which you'll see as thermalization, which is a natural endpoint of turbulence in nature. It thermalizes, dissipates away. From the Navier-Stokes perspective, yes, there is a viscosity term, and so far this has been studied without including this viscosity term, right?
At least. Well, there is a natural viscosity to use Murray.
Yeah. So now that's one of the things that we're hopefully going to do is to crank up the viscosity to a very large number in the Navier-Stokes equation, and maybe it will start pointing in the other direction, the flow.
There's another point which I don't understand. Sometimes when one says it's a singularity, one believes one should stop calculating because this thing is no damn good. Other times when there's a singularity, you continue to calculate because interesting things are going on.
Yes.
I did not understand which of these two cases we were talking about.
Okay, so first, we need to include these terms that grow in time to avoid singularities. We don't want singularities in our spacetime. We want to find a regular smooth evolution of our spacetime. And that's why we need to include these terms that grow in time.
But why do you absolutely need a smooth spacetime?
Because I believe in the cosmic censorship, which tells me that if I have a spacetime that is singular, it better be cloaked by an horizon.
Let me ask a third question, which I hope is helpful too. You talk about reflections from infinity.
Yes.
If you have a slightly more complicated situation, you could imagine infinity getting sort of wavy.
Yes.
And the breaking up of the reflections into something less regular.
Yes.
That will kill much of the focusing.
It will, but it will not kill this instability. The reason being that you do have to wait a much longer time, but you would still see it. It's still a finite. In fact, let me also add another thing. This work that I'm presenting here in a much simpler context, solving the nonlinear Schrodinger equation on a torus, was rigorously shown, okay? So there it was really shown. Here we can't show because Einstein's equations are a little bit more complicated. In a way, the only thing that we have shown is that Einstein equations are not special. There's some PDEs. That's what we have shown. Really,
yeah, I guess you say you don't see this effect until you go to fourth order.
Third order.
Well, I thought you said that, go to fourth order.
We go to fourth order because we want to compute the asymptotic charges to fourth order.
That's true in any dimensionality.
It's still true in five dimensions, at least. Yes. We have shown this for five dimensions.
We don't know about more than five.
No. Okay. But
I'm just wondering if there's some insight why you have to go up that far.
That's a very good question. And in all of these systems where this has been shown with rigor, it is a case. You have to go to third order. Why third? It's, people don't understand.
So, you're right. You do have a black hole, and this black hole should evaporate. And so,
there's no instability at the quantum level. That just means that at the quantum level,
quantum level, it should evaporate.
Yeah, if it evaporates, so there's no instability.
And then you have these waves washing up again, especially for the black hole.
Maybe you said this, but I just, are these new class of black holes with a single failure? Do you have exact solutions?
We have constructed them perturbatively, and in some simple contexts, we have constructed them at the full nonlinear level. Okay, so it means that there is a way in which you can see basically all of this physics by considering you have to go to five dimensions, you have to include a matter, which is a doublet field, it will still have this type of instability, and in that context, we've managed, it reduces to ODEs, nonlinear ODEs, and you can solve them numerically, and we did that. But the physics is essentially the same.
When you extrapolate this to type 2 weak theory, have you taken into account that the dilaton will be turned on in the one successive calculation?
I think you. I don't know, you should tell me this, I'm not a specialist in string theory, but I think you can consistently set the dilaton to zero while having metric perturbations, or not?
No.
No? You'll just have to turn on the dilaton?
No, because you have the cosmological, well, the dilaton equation, if you work in the Einstein frame, you have a conclusion for the cosmological term.
But in any, I was not aware of that. We can easily do that calculation. In any case, I don't think it will change. because it's just some nonlinear PDE solving in a compact domain.
Well, it's you add one equation more.
No, you add one equation more, but in a way that's almost like an easier setup because that's more close to what Rostorovsky and Bizon did. It's a scalar field plus GR, and they still find the this instability. We can do that calculation.
Another small question is, you say generic small perturbation become large.
Yes.
I thought that you were talking about perturbations at the resonance frequencies.
No. So we start with some, so the geons that we have constructed, they form a basis for ADS initial data. So if you start with two, it's like starting with many of them. So that's why it's generic. And we start with frequencies that they're normal modes of ADS, but the resonant frequencies, they will only show up at third order. We don't start with resonant frequencies in a way. You see, you can start with some initial data, decompose it as an infinite sum of these geons, and then evolve them. It so happens that our initial data has two of these guys. But you can construct more if you want.
No, but your initial data will have an infinitesimal component at the resonance
frequency. It depends on what you mean by it's a normal mode. But any initial data can be decomposed as a sum of the normal modes. Right? Normal modes form a base.
Okay, I agree.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'm trying to understand. I mean, right now it doesn't seem like this is so surprising holographically. I mean, your boundary conditions are such that the conformal boundary metric is being perturbed as a function of time. Right?
No, it's not.
Well, you had S, your perturbations are not dying away.
No. I did not explain well. So the metric perturbations decay. It so happens that in terms of this gauge invariant variable, it seems that it doesn't.
So,
is a map between the gauge invariant variable that I show.
So the conformal boundary metric.
It's not changed. Yes.
And the subleading, you're saying the bed of the stress tensor is also, the bed of your stress tensor is also zero?
That's oscillating.
That's oscillating.
Yes.
So I misunderstood. I thought you said that.
No. If it was the other way around, then it would be obvious that you would find generically singularities because it's not a well posed problem.
If there's no other question, Jorge will be here till tomorrow afternoon.